I would like to introduce T.J. Owen.
Thank you, Bill. Hi. I want to say hello to all of you, and if I haven't hugged you yet, I hope I'll have that opportunity. I'm a hugger. And I also want to let you know that the older I get, it seems the more emotional I have become, and it's harder for me to hold into my emotions. So if you see me cry, please don't get upset. I brought the Kleenexes for me and for you if you need them. So come right up and take one. If you cry along with me, that's fine. And if there will be times that you'll want to laugh, and that'll be just fine too. That'll make me feel very comfortable. I want to thank ING Utah for inviting me here to speak. I have to say this is the largest group of non-medical personnel that I have ever spoken to. Normally when I speak to a large group, it's at a hospital, and I'm speaking to doctors and nurses so that they can help a person recover or understand if they have a near-death experience in the hospital. Normally, when I speak about my near-death experience, when I first got started speaking back in 1970, I was talking to the terminally ill because that's what God wanted. That was the point of my near-death experience. Cry, laugh, whatever, and I hope you all come up and give me a hug when I'm done. My near-death experience, as Bill said, took place in 1969. My near-death experience has been used in research, so I talked to a lot of doctors and has been quoted in 4 other books. And I know that many of you have already heard and or read near-death experiences, or perhaps you've even had one yourself. So I hope tonight I can bring some new insights. And I'm not going to read you my book. But what I am, because this is a very special group, I'm going to give you more intimate information that isn't in the book, that I normally do not share with other people, because it is so personal. Because I had my near-death experience in 1969, there was a lot of stigma and rejection. For a while, I stuck to very simple things and didn't give a lot of detail. Otherwise, they would want to lock me up in a mental hospital. My near-death experience happened long before all the research, and even Dr. Moody wouldn't coin the term near-death experience for another 6 years. So I had no information or preconceived ideas about near-deaths. I didn't know they even existed. But I believe that it was the 21 years before my near-death experience that influenced some of what happened in a very big way. To start, I'm going to begin at the beginning of my life, which is something I normally never give out information. I was born in 1947 in a very multi-generational, diverse, and multi-ethnic family. My mother called me her United Nations child because I have so much mixed blood. And I lived in Los Angeles, California in a blue-collar neighborhood sharing a small bedroom with my 2 sisters, one younger and one older. We shared everything including sleeping in the same double bed until I was 14 years old. Each of us was very different in looks and personality. My family was always drinking alcohol and smoking. I learned to mix drinks and light cigarettes and pipes before I was 8 years old. I could cuss in 3 languages by the time I was 3 years old. And the adults thought that made me smart and funny. Swearing was just normal conversation. There was loud arguing because of the large family. And sometimes that became violent. The one thing we didn't have in my family was any form of religion. The words God and Jesus were just dirty words. I was exposed to most worldly things, and I wasn't hovered over. Us kids were ranged, not raised, which means that when the sun shined, we were outside unless we were sick or assigned a work detail inside. Often I would find a quiet, secluded place outside just to do my homework or read a book in silence. For me, being alone as a child in silent place was heaven. Most of the men in my neighborhood had seen action not just in World War II, but also in Korea. I remember when the men left for Korea, and I remember those that didn't come home. I learned early that the best way to cope with this world was to do as I was told and to make as little fuss as possible. I was to be seen and not heard, and that's how I was trained as a child. I didn't fear many things like other kids did. I didn't fear snakes, spiders, the darkness, bumblebees, or even the boogeyman under the bed. I wasn't prone to nightmares even when I had fevers, but I did have fears as a child, and the biggest fears had just cause. My number one fear was the fear of death, and that started at 5 years old. I had visions that my five-year-old best friend was going to die. The how of his death, but not the when. I went to my family about these visions because I wanted them to help the boy, but they became angry with me. They were spooked that I was having visions at all. Sorry, memories. The vision became a reality, and I was present and there and saw my friend die before I had even started kindergarten. After my five-year-old friend died, my mom surprised me one Sunday. She walked me a very long way to the nearest church and enrolled me in a kindergarten Sunday school class. She hoped that church could help me overcome my grief because my family couldn't, because they had no religion. But when I started first grade, Mom stopped taking me to Sunday school. She thought a year of church was more than enough, and that was the end of that. My second fear, as you can imagine, was of punishment. I learned early about punishment. It was done with military precision, even when I had done nothing to deserve it. My eighth year of life was the toughest year for me. I lost another best friend to polio. When she came home from the hospital in an iron lung, I had to break all the rules to visit her because my family wouldn't allow it. I had no visions about this friend dying, but yes, she did die, reinforcing my number one fear of death. This same year, which was a terrible year, my favorite beloved uncle who helped raise me was a small, quiet gentleman, had a nervous breakdown. That's what the family called it. I witnessed five men forcing my uncle to the ground and putting him in a straitjacket. He had become extremely violent. People said he was crazy, and from the actions I witnessed that day, I believed that. It frightened me. I learned to fear people. I also feared that I would lose myself as well. You see, it was that same year I lost my temper with a big bully that terrorized everyone. No one did anything about him. One day he was hurting my little sister and me. Then he kicked my dog, who was barking at the boy. It was the last straw. My temper rose up like a forest fire and went totally out of control. Blackout, mad, out of control. It was a small repeat of how I had last seen my uncle. He was locked up in a mental hospital in California State for more than 2 years. It took two men to get me off of that big bully kid. I had only used my hands, but there was so much blood, and none of it was mine. The boy had to go into the hospital for stitches. So my third fear that began to rule over my life and all my actions was the fear of mental illness and that I would lose myself into that darkness as well. This was the first time I had lost control over myself, and it was terrifying. I promised myself that I would never, ever get angry again, no matter what. I would never make a fuss about anything, even when I should have. It surprised me that I wasn't punished for hurting the boy. In fact, my family and neighbors worried about me because I went into a kind of shock over what I had done. People said the bully got what he deserved by being beaten up by a little girl. I found adults bizarre and undependable. Lucky for me, at the end of my traumatic eighth year, a big church was built down the street, and my mother told me if I wanted, I could go all alone by myself and walk to this church. By the time I turned 12 years old, I had been walking to that Sunday school class and church services all alone, sporadically, for 3 years. It was at this time a new older pastor and his wife took over the church and things suddenly changed. The new preacher, as he wanted to be called, was a fierce shouter and always banging his Bible on the pulpit telling us all about sin, hell, and brimstone. Him and his wife frightened me, but I was no quitter. I stayed. When I walked into my sixth grade Sunday school class for the very first time, the teacher was the preacher's wife. A voice in my head told me to turn around and go home, but I didn't. Things went well for a few months. Then one day the preacher's wife said that we were all going to spend time learning to pray the right way. Then she said that if we prayed wrong, God would punish us. I envisioned in my large imagination a very big leather belt coming down on my backside, so I began listening very closely. The teacher said this was a true story of her friend, a young woman who had a 5-year-old son dying in the hospital. This woman prayed wrong. She prayed for her son's life, and God punished her by healing her son and turning her child evil. He became a murderer who was sentenced to death and died in the electric chair in California, all to punish his mother for praying wrong. My fears and the remembrances of my 5-year-old and my 8-year-old's friend's deaths and their grieving mothers wouldn't let me stay silent anymore. I made a very big fuss. I jumped out of my seat crying and began to yell at the teacher. No, no, God wouldn't punish a mother over a few spoken words than make a child evil just to punish that mother. Not my God. The teacher came at me yelling that I was an evil child and God was going to punish me. She looked like she was going to hit me, and I knew what that felt like. I ran out of the room like my life depended on it. The woman actually chased me right into a busy street with oncoming traffic. I worried she would follow me home. I would sure be punished by my family then for making trouble. I hid in neighborhood yards so the teacher couldn't find me. By the time I got home, I was frightened and exhausted, but I didn't tell anyone what had happened that Sunday for fear of being punished. Unfortunately, the next Friday night, my two sisters and I were left home alone. At around 7 p.m., the doorbell began to ring, then came the pounding of fists on the wooden door, and then the loud, awful yelling began. The preacher and his wife had found me. They began screaming for us to open the door because I was an evil child and they weren't going to go away. They wanted to yell at my parents too, who had no idea what had happened. My sisters didn't know these people and why they were even there. My sisters were terrified. I got angry. What I did was the unthinkable. I broke all the rules. I called a neighbor whose name was Bill, and Bill was a giant of a man with the temperament of a kitten, and he was the one adult that I trusted. I explained exactly what was happening and why. He immediately came to our rescue. Bill scared them off. I opened the door and ran into Bill's arms, which was against the rule, and he comforted all three of us girls. We made him promise that he wouldn't tell our parents what had happened because we feared the punishment that would take place because we had opened the door. That night, I, a 12-year-old girl, prayed to a God I wasn't sure even existed. I was not kind with my words. I told God that I was never going to any church ever again unless He personally came down and faced me and pointed out what church He wanted me to go to and told me what to believe. Then I cried myself to sleep that night, feeling abandoned and rejected. I kept that promise. I put God and religion out of my mind and out of my life. Now, fast forward 6 years. I was 18 years old. I had gotten married. I had left home. I had a high school graduation. I got my diploma. I finished a NASA class in electronics at the top of the class, and I had been hired by a large aerospace company. I was going to college 4 nights a week after work, and I felt like for the first time in my life, I had control over my life. And the new birth control pill was all the rage. I went to a gynecologist, my first, for a physical to get birth control pills because I didn't want a pregnancy to interfere with my life. The doctor told me that I didn't need any birth control pills because it was impossible for me to get pregnant. I had problems, but my parents never took me to a doctor. Now this doctor was telling me that I was a real mess, and he wanted to schedule a hysterectomy right then at 18. I thought about it for, 5 whole seconds. I didn't want to take the time away from my work or school, so I said no. The doctor wasn't very happy with my decision. Walking to my car that evening, I broke my silence with God just for a moment. God, if you want me to get pregnant, then I will, and I'll have kids somehow. Isn't that right, God? I asked, but I expected no answer. I saw doctors for problems and physicals about twice a year, and other doctors told me exactly what the first had. There was no change, and I needed a hysterectomy. Now, fast forward 3 more years. It was a few weeks away from my 21st birthday. It was 1968, another physical. I had already had an extremely stressful and upsetting day. Dr. Boston examined me. It was the first time I had met him. With my medical insurance, each time I went in, I wouldn't get to pick my doctor, so each time I saw someone different. Dr. Boston turned out to be part doctor and part comedian, but I was in no mood, so I was pretty much ignoring him, when suddenly he joyfully jumped up, telling me I was pregnant. It was a giant surprise. I thought this guy was crazy, and I told him how rude he was. But then he kindly explained that I was definitely pregnant, and he gave me a due date of March 20th, 1969. I left his office in a daze. This pregnancy was a big medical miracle, but not just that. It was a sign, and a very big one. For you see, I had actually asked God to give me a big sign about my life, about where I was supposed to be going and what I was supposed to be doing. And my life at that time was unhappy and very confusing. Again, never expecting an answer, I had asked God to help me. Fast forward 7 months to March 20th, which was my due date. I lived a healthy, active life. Every doctor visit, I was told I was very healthy and the baby was fine. They wanted me to get up to 140 pounds before I delivered, and I did. That day, the doctor told me that I was dilated 1 centimeter, and you ladies, most of you already know what that means, and the baby's head was in the birth position. The problem was that I already started having what I thought were labor pains. The pain was intermittent, strong, wrong, and extremely troubling. I explained this to the doctor. I didn't know, but I was assured it was false labor and perfectly normal, and I was sent home without making any fuss. Each doctor visit ended exactly the same. I was scolded and told to eat, rest, and the baby would come anytime. I would leave the hospital not wanting to make a fuss. That was the MO from my life. But nothing was perfectly normal. Then the visions began, just like when I was 5 years old. I was told that I would die in childbirth in a bowl of agonizing pain. I thought it was just hormonal stress. Wednesday, April 2nd, 1969. I was almost 2 weeks past my due date. I showed up for another appointment alone, as I always did, but this time I was fighting off panic, fear, and exhaustion. I was elated to see Dr. Boston once again. He would be examining me. I hoped I could convince him, the comic, that something had gone terribly wrong. I stayed silent as he examined me. When he happily told me I was dilated 1 centimeter, that the baby was in position, and I would start real labor any second. Then he scolded me for having lost 3 more pounds. I began crying, talking fast and too loud, and telling him pitifully how painful this false labor was, about how I wasn't eating or sleeping. I did not tell him about the visions. He could see that I was fragile mentally and emotionally. I started insisting he put me in the hospital now. The doctor told me if I went into the hospital and it was false labor, they would just send me home again. He finally said, TJ, how about this? No more coming to the doctor's because I had to travel about 60 miles. I was to stay home, put my feet up, do nothing but rest and eat, eat, eat. If I hadn't delivered by Monday, April the 7th, which was 4 days away, then my next appointment would definitely be with him at 10 a.m., and he would induce labor. I accepted his offer without question. I went home to wait and suffer some more. The next night was Thursday, April the 3rd. I was again doing my usual quiet pacing in the living room, and the pain was fierce. When a pain struck me so hard, I actually dropped like a stone to my knees. I was done being nice. I decided to go to the hospital and fight for my life. I told myself that at the hospital I would be safe. At the hospital, a man I didn't know named Dr. Marks showed up to examine me. I was ready for a fight when he told me I was actually in labor, and I was now dilated 4 centimeters, and it takes 10 centimeters to deliver a baby. Dr. Marks smiled and said that everything was fine. He was wrong. My pain went to full on with no rest. Dr. Marks broke my water, and the exact words out of his mouth spoken very loudly were, shit, dry birth. I made him explain what that meant, and it wasn't happy. He found out the baby was now being born back first. He was breech. Dr. Marks, in gruesome detail, told me this was a problem, yes, but nothing he couldn't overcome. He was wrong for the second time. put me on my side, hoping that nature and gravity would turn the baby back down into proper birth position. He wanted me to sleep, but that was beyond happening. He wanted to force me to accept pain medication. I said no. My mom's first pregnancy was during World War II. She was medicated, and she lost a healthy baby boy, and she almost died herself. So I wasn't going to do the same. I knew by this time that I was truly in trouble because my vision was becoming a reality. This decision about no pain meds that I would never go back on worried Dr. Marks even more. But at last, Dr. Marks said it was enough. It was cesarean section time. I was ready for that. We signed papers. Dr. Marks was setting up for the operation, and the nurses were prepping me for surgery when nature and gravity intervened. The baby turned, and not a nice, gentle turn. I could feel my skin stretching and tearing. Immediately, the baby and I went into full distress. I was pushed, not into the operating room, but into the X-ray room. When I returned to the labor room, it was full of doctors with sour faces. I was told in disgusting details that I had actually been in labor for 2 weeks. The X-ray showed that I was 12 centimeters dilated on the right and the left, where the doctors couldn't see or feel, but in the center I was 4 centimeters, and nothing would ever change that. There had never been any possibility that I could deliver a baby in the normal way. But now, the doctors told me the baby was stuck in the birth canal and with his oxygen cut off. I was told that the baby was still physically alive, but the baby was now brain dead. They told me they couldn't do a cesarean section to remove the baby because I was in too bad a shape. There was a slim chance, 75% chance, that I would die on the table. They only gave me a 25% chance if I had a C-section that I would live, which was no chance at all. The only way I might live, all these doctors were shouting at me, was to let them do an immediate abortion. They told me the plan, which also frightened and disgusted me. They were going to keep me awake so that I could push and cooperate. They were going to cut off the baby's head and into 4 pieces, and I would push, and then they would fold the body of the baby into sections and hope that I could push hard enough to push the dead baby out. But even with 4 doctors working to save my life, my chances were only 50-50, even if they made no mistakes. I was told by the head doctor that my husband had signed the papers for this abortion. Now I needed to say yes. But to make this horrendous decision myself was terrible. I wanted someone else besides a doctor I didn't trust or a family member I didn't trust to tell me what to do. But I wanted this responsibility off of my shoulders, so what did I do? Yes, I prayed. Please, God. That was all I could manage before I was being pressured to say yes and get on with the abortion. I was in the process of saying a very loud yes because they told me to, when a loud but compassionate voice came into my brain. The word was no. Then came other words. Wait. Have faith. Fear not. pray. That was all I needed to hear. My simple prayer had been answered, and I was going to go with God's answer. For 9 years, I hadn't thought much about God, nor had I gone to church of any kind. There had been some simple, pleading, childish prayers through the years. I would read my child's Bible during troubled times, but not much else, since my 12-year-old defiant self had prayed after that night when the preacher and his wife had scared my sisters. But soon, all my childhood prayers would be answered all at once and in a very big way. I put all my faith in God, and when I accepted that I was being led by God, all my panic and fear dissolved. My fight mode went into action. I didn't understand everything. I just knew that some miracle was coming. My baby and I would live. It was a child's like faith. But saying no was not acceptable to the doctors. They began to browbeat me until one doctor went way too far. He told me in so many words that I was a stupid little girl and that my husband who had signed the papers knew what was right. This doctor was screaming in my face. I let my temper come all the way to the top. I yelled right back at him. I threatened his life. I told him that if he didn't get out of my room, I was going to cut his head off and kill him. He jumped back from me and left the labor room in a really big huff, muttering that he would see about this. His entourage followed him out of the room, and I was left all alone. I was alone in the room calming myself down. I didn't want to go mad. And it seemed a very long time when Dr. Marks finally returned. He put his head in his hands, and he said nothing for a while. Then I shyly and tearfully asked him if that bad doctor could abort without my permission. He said no, and I felt relieved. Then Dr. Mark asked me, like he was speaking to a deaf person, "Now, what do you want me to do?" I didn't have an answer. I sure wasn't going to tell him a voice was telling me what to do. I told him I was going to wait for God to make the decision. If I died, I told the doctor to save the baby. If the baby died, then he was to try his best to save me. I thought that was a simple answer. He said it wasn't simple. He told me how impossible this request was in full, gruesome details, but I told him strongly that he was to get prepared and to try anyway. He got up and left without a word, but when he came back into the room, he held a filled stainless steel tray, and he put it on the counter. "Okay," he said sarcastically. "Better?" Then he left the room. After that, it was just a waiting game. I had few visits from a nurse or even Dr. Marks. I had already refused visits with my husband, and you can see or read the book on that chapter. I spent my time teaching myself what I would later learn was self-hypnosis. I was focusing away from the pain in any way that I could. I just focused on staying alive. It wasn't long before Dr. Mark came in looking a little happier. He had a proposition for me. He got permission to give me shots in my cervix, which would dull the pain, but would not take it completely away, so that, as he put it, I could hold out longer. The unspoken word, it was so that I could live until I got smart. He told me that none of the meds would get into the baby's bloodstream because that's what I feared, so I agreed. After that, I spent all of my time focusing away from the pain and thinking about nothing else. Fast forward many hours. I was waiting for my next shot because the pain had gotten so much worse. When Dr. Marks came into the room and stood at the foot of my bed, and a young nurse came to the head of the bed and took my hand. Sorry, this is just like yesterday for me. I'm sorry. Dr. Marks told me no more shots. Hospital's orders. And under his breath that I could hear, he angrily told me that the hospital had just given me a death sentence. Dr. Marks told me bluntly that I had less than 2 hours to live. Without the shots giving me some pain relief, TJ, the pain will get worse quickly and you will die, he said. He poetically told me I would live to see another dawn. Then he put his head in his hands and he bowed his head in prayer. I was stunned, terrified, and silent, and no one was saying another word. I had lost all sense of time and I had to break the silence in the room. So I stupidly asked the nurse what time it was. 9, she said mechanically. I didn't know if it was night or day, so I asked if it was 9 at night. It was at daytime. Then when the nurse told me it was night, I then asked another stupid question. I wanted to know what day it was. The nurse, who was still standing like a statue, she told me it was April 5th, Saturday. I couldn't believe I had only been in the hospital for 3 days and 3 nights. I stopped asking questions. Dr. Marks and the nurse remained silent. I cried. Then suddenly the nurse burst into tears and ran out of the room. That was when Dr. Marks and I got into a little fight because he wanted to punish the nurse for her unprofessionalism, because she had cried, left the room, and hadn't returned. I let him know that that punishment wasn't going to happen. But at the end of our loud conversation, I was no longer calling him Dr. Marks. I was calling him by his first name, Tom. I learned he was married with kids, and he had a little talk about death and God. Then he told me that he was going to break the hospital rules and he was going to let everyone who had been waiting for me for 3 days in the waiting room come in to be with me in my room to watch me die. Shocked, I yelled, "No, don't you do that to me." I knew that I still had to wait, and I still had to pray as instructed. If I was to try to stay alive in front of crying family members, it would kill me, and way faster than I wanted or needed, because I was raised that tears were weakness, and so I never tried to cry. I forced myself not to cry at any family event. I told Tom to leave the room too, and he refused. He wasn't going to let a patient die alone. I told him I wouldn't be alone because I needed to talk to God and pray alone. It took some time for me to convince Tom to leave, but he finally agreed. I asked him to unhook me from all the machines and take the IVs out of my hands. He fluffed up my pillow and straightened my sheets all by himself. He didn't ask for a nurse to help, and I thanked him. Then he pulled the nurse's call button off the wall. He placed it in my swollen, sore hand and gently put my thumb on the button. Then he mournfully said, "If you change your mind, TJ, I will be sitting right outside your door and I'll come in. I'll sit with you, or whatever you want." He slowly and reluctantly turned out the lights and closed the door behind him. The room was instantly blanketed into total darkness. At first I felt afraid, but then I scolded myself. I was never afraid of the dark before, and I sure wasn't going to start then. I tried to pray out loud to the ceiling that I couldn't see, but it sounded all wrong and false, so I began to sing out loud to the room. First, it was Sunday school songs like "Jesus Loves Me," but I kept getting blocked from remembering the words, so I changed to the more familiar "And You Can Laugh." I began to sing Christmas carols. "Joy to the world, the Lord has come." Now that is funny, I know. I sang Christmas carols as many as I could remember. Then the words and the tunes became blocked to me as well. I then changed to Bible verses, and that too was blocked because I didn't know very many. I knew it was because I was supposed to pray, not sing, and I had to pray for real this time. In anger and frustration, I started shouting to the ceiling, and it wasn't pretty. I said angry things like, "God, you cheated. You fooled me. Why are you punishing me?" And so on. But in the end, I knew all was lost. I then lost my anger. I began to talk to God like a friend. "God, you know I have always been yours, so take me now. Don't let me suffer anymore. Please, I beg you." Then suddenly I remembered that I had an unborn child that was still living inside of me. "God, I'm giving you my baby's soul freely too. Now please, God, kill me." I felt let down, and yes, I felt cheated, but there was nothing I could do to change anything. There was nothing left for me to do but die. I then focused on all the pain. I curled into that ball that I had seen in my vision and took all the pain, praying for it to be over fast. And surprisingly, it was. I died. And it didn't take me 2 hours to do it. I did not go through a tunnel. I knew nothing about tunnels. I went right into the bright light that should have hurt my eyes. For me, there was this marvelous silence that I had longed for, living in a noisy family and world all my life. I thought of many possible things that might take me to what I thought was going to be heaven, but nothing was happening. So I just watched, waited, and listened, and sensed what was all around me. I felt warm, safe, no pain or fear, just love. Someone was lovingly watching over me. I had no thoughts of hell. I just felt like for the first time in my life, I was home. I belonged here. I was me, and I was finally free. I didn't know what heaven was supposed to be, but being a part of that beautiful light felt like I was close to heaven and God. Then I sensed I was in some kind of hall or near a wall. I felt like there was a center full of movement and light, and there were others there waiting, long awaiting. So I had waited long enough, and I'm always asking myself questions after questions, being an engineer, and I was getting no answers. So I set out on my own, strong and full of enthusiasm. I went to what I felt was this river of rainbow energy that was moving deeper into the light. That was where I wanted to go. But when I stuck my foot in the river, I was immediately folded in half, like a big rubber band had been tied around my waist. I could see and almost touch my bare toes. I was told it wasn't my time. So nonchalantly, I didn't want to go back. I wanted to stay in the light. I wanted to go forward, not backwards. I was told it wasn't my time, but I was pulled back at lightning speed. I found myself back to that terrible labor room, levitating over a bed and a body that I focused on. It took me a moment to realize that that body was me. But when I did understand, I began to feel like a feather floating back and forth until I was back into that cold, still, dead body. Back in my body, I felt so heavy and cold, but again, I began to think, what had just happened to me? I told myself I must have just had a very vivid dream, and that Dr. Marks must have opened the door, turned on the lights, and come into the room. I smiled, and I kept my eyes closed, and I waited for the doctor to come and touch me. My plan was to surprise him that I was still alive, but I didn't hear him. I could see bright light through my closed eyelids, so I opened my eyes. I looked up at the ceiling. I could see that the ceiling lights weren't on, but the room was filled with that beautiful, loving, warm light from the so-called dream. I again took inventory. I was awake, strong, and wonderfully, there was no pain at all. As I looked around me, I could see everything was brightly lit. I first thought with some smugness that I had lived to see a new dawn. I thought it was morning and the light was coming in through the windows. Then in shock, I remembered I was on the fifth floor and there were no windows. I was in the middle of the hospital. I got an adrenaline rush when suddenly a loud male voice brought me totally back to life and sitting straight up in bed. The male voice said, "You cannot give him to me, for he is already mine." The voice was so loud in my ears and in my head that it even rattled my teeth. Those few words came with a very big message. I couldn't give my child to God because he already belonged to God, just as I did. I saw my son, his beautiful face, alive and well in my arms, but I knew he was still inside my body. I knew that he and I would live now, but the fly in the ointment was that my son would be born alive, but that I would live to bury my son in the future. I wasn't given the when, how, or the where of his death. I began to grieve strongly, but then my emotions were dissolved because there was a lot more information that I needed, and the information began to flow very fast. It filled my little one-gallon brain, and the information was too much for me. I tried to stop it, slow it down, freeze it. I wanted control, but no luck there. I was told to watch and listen, and when the time came, I would know and understand all. So I did relax. I just let the images and the information flow inside of me. Then another voice I heard on my left showed me my past. After that, another voice from the right suddenly took me into the future. My future wasn't going to be all happy and golden or even healthy. I didn't want to see it. The most important part was when I saw myself about 9 years in the future, because it was a crossroads in my life that they wanted me to see. I hated what I was seeing because I was cursing God, telling him I wasn't going to follow his plans anymore. I wanted to be left alone, but then I remembered my near-death experience, which was the point after all. So I saw myself in the future get on my knees and pray for strength. Then I saw all the angels, dozens of them, all around me, comforting me and letting me know that I would never be abandoned. God loved me no matter what. There was no wrong way to pray. Then I saw the future to the year 2048. I would never have another child. I would have that hysterectomy, and that surgery would almost kill me. And the next surgery, and the next. Each time I would tell those doctors what to expect. And each doctor would think that I was a very strange woman until what I told them would happen during surgery did happen, down to the exact minute. That was my future and now my present. The male voice at the foot of my bed shocked me once again by saying, "I am your creator." That made my heart pound. That creator gave me a new name. He told me he had named me before my birth. He knew about my angry prayer when I was 12, and he wasn't angry at me at all. I was told that there wasn't a religion or a church, of which there were tens of thousands of different belief systems in the world. None had all the right answers, but each had a golden nugget of truth. It was now my job to go out into this world to learn and to find all of that treasure. I was to seek out truth in all things. Skepticism wasn't a bad thing. Anger wasn't a bad thing. Fighting for my rights or the rights of others nonviolently wasn't a bad thing either. And most importantly, I was told I was never to let fear stop me ever again. I was told to stay married to my husband. The voice said about the man, you can read the book about this as well, if he, my husband, wanted to leave me, I could let him leave. But if he wanted to stay with me, then I should let him stay. The voice firmly stated, "Woman, how do you not know that because of you, he will be saved. In the end, I was told to bring the doctor back into the labor room and force him to do the C-section. I was promised that I wouldn't die, and the boy, my son, would live for now as my gift, my bright and shining star. I didn't want the male voice and the light and the angels to leave. I had so many questions. I didn't even know the name of the voice that was speaking to me. His name I wanted. I couldn't say he was God. I didn't think that was right. I was a nobody. I was just a tiny, unbaptized ant, and pretty much most of my life a non-believer. I couldn't believe the God of Sunday school and church would be standing at the foot of my bed talking to me, even though at 12 years old, I had actually asked for this. I didn't know what a Holy Spirit was with so little religious education, but the word and the name Jesus, I knew that name, so I grabbed onto that idea. I could deal with Jesus talking to me. That was okay. As the light began to fade, Jesus, as I was now calling him, kept telling me with amusement in his voice, not laughing at me, but so loving and even this sense of pride in me that I could feel. He kept saying, TJ, push the call button. As the room went back into total darkness, I was yelling, what call button? And feeling around my sheets because the room had become completely dark. I found the cord and then I pushed that button with my thumb with all my might. My hand hurt like crazy. It was stiff and swollen from where the IV had been in. So I pushed that button and I left my thumb on it, never letting up. I was sitting up in bed, strong, laughing, crying, and waiting. I was happy because my life had been changed completely and forever. The book goes into detail about me waiting a very long time for anyone to come into him. Dr. Marks finally arrived, not a nurse. He was frightened and he didn't want to come into the room because he was thinking he would find a dead woman. What he found was me sitting up in bed laughing and crying, strong, healed, and alive. I was talking very fast, trying to convince him to do the C-section. Dr. Marks, after asking if I was sure about this, finally said, okay, what could it hurt? Then ran out of the room screaming for assistance. Papers were signed releasing the hospital and all doctors of any responsibility because they thought it was just a dead woman asking for something. I was given a spinal and the surgery started. At first I was awake, laughing and talkative, but then I got tired and got bored. There was nothing for me to see. I asked if I could go to sleep, and I did without fear. I woke up once from the sounds of my own snoring, and I could hear the operating room personnel talking and laughing at my loud snoring sounds too. So I laughed, and then I went back to sleep. The next time I woke up, it wasn't because I was snoring. What woke me up was loud cursing, swearing, praying, and yelling. It was Dr. Marks. He was in a panic, yelling to hurry and get the baby out. Then he yelled, "Please, God, give us more time. She has been through so much." Then he would go back to swearing and yelling for the numbers. A man I couldn't see began shouting numbers I didn't understand. And then when I did, I was shocked. They were calling out the numbers of my blood pressure, my heart rate, my respiration rate, etc. And the numbers were way too low. I realized that once again, I was dying. Or at least Dr. Marks thought I was. That's why he was yelling to hurry up. I decided I needed to speak up and tell them I wasn't going to die. I tried to open my eyes, but nothing worked. I tried to take a breath. Nothing. I was cold and getting colder. Once again, I feared death. So once again, I began to panic. Inside of my head, I began to scream, "Jesus said I won't die. And if Jesus said it, I won't." I was fighting to open my eyes, breathe, scream. I even envisioned myself getting off that cold operating table. As my numbers were being shouted out and heading down to all zeros, I suddenly took in a deep breath. I began to scream, and everyone in the room jumped. I was screaming, "Jesus said I won't die." Dr. Marks told me to keep screaming and told Dr. Goldstein, who was actually doing the C-section, to hurry up, tossing in all the cuss words as well. I didn't want to scream anymore. I wanted to see a human face and feel the human touch. Dr. Marks told the nurse to do what I asked, and she did. Seeing her face and feeling the heat of her hands calmed me. I was so cold, I couldn't feel my fingers or my toes. Her hands were like fire, but I needed that. The baby was soon removed and sent to the right because they had called in a full neonatology team for the baby. I listened to what was going on, happy that the baby was now free from my body in case they needed to shock me. This new voice sounded tired and gruffed. "You got me out of bed for this, Tom?" This was what Dr. Peterson said angrily. "There is nothing wrong with this baby." I heard Dr. Marks move toward the baby, who was not crying, but I was no longer afraid or worried about anything. That fear had fled from me once again. Dr. Marks' voice changed. I could hear the amazement in his voice, and he said, "My God, TJ, this baby is just fine. He weighs 9 pounds and 6 ounces. He has bullets in his butt." Everyone laughed at that remark. He then announced the 2 a.m. birth. Then a nurse on my left, in an amazed tone, said, "Dr. Marks, it's Sunday, Easter Sunday." The room became instantly silent. Dr. Marks then slowly announced, "Yes, baby boy, born 2 a.m. Easter Sunday, Happy Easter, everyone. The doctor's voice sounded like he was fighting tears. He told me my boy was perfect, except for a big knob on his head, and that old Dr. Peterson would just mold it back to normal in no time at all. I hadn't remembered that the three-day holiday was Easter. Easter would no longer be bunnies, decorated eggs, and candy for me. I found out later others who witnessed this miracle that morning changed too. I asked Dr. Marks if I could go back to sleep. I didn't need to see the baby because I already had. And I did go back to sleep with no fear. I woke up 8 hours later worried about a poor woman who was moaning in pain behind privacy curtains that were next to me. I was strong, healed, and ready to go home, but I felt much older than my 21 years. Then I learned I would have to stay in the hospital for 2 weeks, but I got out of the hospital the following Friday, just 5 days after surgery. And when Dr. Goldstein came in to remove my bandages, he credited my healing of the stitches and no blood on the bandage as his professionalism and not God's. I made a big fuss because I wanted to go home. When they were weighing me fully dressed before going home, the scale said I weighed only 98 pounds. I looked like I was coming out of a death camp, and I have the pictures to prove it. But I was happy to be alive, and the new paranormal events had started even before I had left the hospital. I knew nothing about near death and what had actually happened to me. No one wanted to talk to me about it, except when I tried to explain this to Dr. Marks. He said when I was on the operating table, I couldn't possibly have heard anything he had said because I was in a coma. I then explained to him word for word every swear word he had said. He went into shock and then told me they would have to change their procedures on dealing with people who were in a coma. After I got home, people thought I was crazy or drugged, or I was dreaming, or something. They knew nothing about near death, and nobody wanted to listen. But for the next 47 years, the paranormal kept happening to remind me. It was a constant reminder to believe in hope, in love, in God, in life, and to have no fear. I was told and shown during my near-death experience that my life wasn't going to be easy or simple, and it hasn't. But having the near-death experience has helped me in enormous ways. I've had cancer 6 times. I am still standing before you, and I know 4 times the doctors have told me I didn't have cancer, and so I lost my temper and said, do the surgery. Afterwards, they apologized to me because they had been wrong. I don't think I could have gotten through this life with all the pre-knowledge about about my own life that I would need to fight for my life many times again. I was told to write a book. I finally did, but very reluctantly. It was the hardest thing I ever had to do, was to write this book. I was told to speak out about my near-death experience and what had happened to me. I had no one I thought I could speak to, so I started speaking with the dying. First in a terminal ward in California in 1970. And it was because of a paranormal experience on a rainy day in 1970. And you can read about what happened to put me at the terminal ward to start talking to the dying. Did the future I was shown happen? Yes. I don't fear death anymore. I don't fear punishment. And I don't fear mental illness. I have worked with the dying since 1970. I work with the mentally ill. I am a chaplain for hospice. I don't fear losing myself. Because through my near-death experience, I found myself. I work to prevent suicides. And yes, I have taken a gun out of a stranger's hands and walked him back into his life. I've been told what I do as a volunteer is crazy, helping the terminally ill and the mentally ill. They can call me whatever name they want, and I'll still continue doing it. I see visions. Yes, I hear voices, and I listen. I pray to the God I love, and who loves me just as I am. I'm not perfect, sorry. I'm very human. And that's okay too. Did I bury my son? Yes, I did. And this is information I'm giving you, and this is the first time this will be revealed. My son died in an industrial accident in 2005, 4 hours after his death. In a vision, I saw the entire accident and his death. I helped OSHA with the accident investigation, and my husband was amazed at what I couldn't possibly know, but I did, because it was my son that walked me through the whole accident. I had witnessed his death as he had mine almost 36 years before, almost to the day. Then he waved goodbye to me with a wonderful smile on his face, walking next to his angels, ready and willing to move to the next phase of his existence. I'm very proud of him. He has visited me 3 times, always bringing me information to ease my way into my future. Did I save my husband? We will be married 51 years this July. He says I have saved him and more. There is more than one doctor who has told me that I have saved his life as well, because I can see his illness before they do. My book doesn't come close to telling it all. I just don't have the words. Stuart Chase said, and I quote, "For those who believe, no proof is necessary. For those who don't believe, no proof is possible." I can only tell you what I learned, what I saw, and what I believe, and the rest is up to you. What did I learn during my near-death experience? I learned that death is not an end. There is change, and that we all are connected, and we are never alone, and so much more. If I did have the words, 100 volumes of books couldn't tell it all, because the first vision and the words during my near-death experience told and showed me creation and gave me the name of God in Hebrew. I know that sounds crazy. For me, it was mind-blowing. I had to go back into the world and learn to speak Hebrew. I learned about the Torah, and I also began to study physics because I needed to find out what I had learned in my near-death experience, if it was actually true. So I am constantly, as an electrical engineer, searching for new research to find out if they are right. Most of the time I find about 50% of the science, they still haven't got it right. But I am wonderfully thrilled every time the Hubble, especially in its near far field research, of which my mother helped to build the Hubble telescope, finds new galaxies. I'm thrilled about the Kepler telescope that finds new planets. I also study quantum theory because during my near-death experience, I was told about how one atom on one side of our universe can affect an atom 14 billion years across the universe. I was also told that our thinking can affect small molecular structures. Our thinking, especially in the negative, can harm you. So you must think constantly of love and the positive. And it is the small kindnesses that are so very big and far-reaching, even the ones we never even know about. You save one person and you save the world, and we are all part of God. We are made by God, for God, and from God. We are loved and need to love. The world isn't going to end tomorrow or anytime soon. Don't look for that. Even though the internet and the news tells you otherwise, the world is actually in a better shape today than it was 50 years ago. Do your research. Don't let the propaganda of bad news make you worried or anxious and take away your happiness. Live your life with hope and joy each day. Give thanks and be grateful for everything, everyone, and every moment you have. Live your life to the fullest every single day. That is what my book is about. Don't sleepwalk through your life, because your life is a gift. It is time to believe in life, in the power of hope and love. You are not alone. You are all connected, so be good to each other. Your life is in your hands. Do the very best you can with the time that you have. This life is a gift, so use it well. I would like to close with the last quote from my book. People are often unreasonable, illogical, and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you are successful, you will win some false friends and some true enemies. Succeed anyway. If you are honest and frank, people may cheat you. Be honest and frank anyway. What you spend years building, someone could destroy overnight. Build anyway. If you find serenity and happiness, they may be jealous. Be happy anyway. The good you do today, people will often forget tomorrow. Do good anyway. Give the world the best you have, and it may never be enough. Give the world the best you've got anyway. You see, in the final analysis, it is between you and God. It was never between you and them anyway. Thank you.
You had mentioned that the visions kept coming. You said that after your near-death experience that you continue to have visions, and you alluded to that you're basically a medical medium. Okay, so explain some of the visions that you've had, or is that in your book?
That's a rough one. Unfortunately, usually the visions are about death. If you read my book, you'll find out I knew that when my father was going to die, when my sister was going to die, and as a hospice chaplain, and I'm working with a patient, I usually know when they'll die. And so therefore I know when and how to work with the family to allow the loved one to pass and then to do the grief counseling. And if I do have a vision, most of the time it revolves around my family or myself. As a perfect example, when I went in to have my hysterectomy, I was told that I had to talk to the anesthesiologist because at an hour and 15 minutes into the surgery, I would quit breathing and he had to be ready so he could save my life. And it happened exactly to the minute.
I just want to say from one hospice chaplain to another.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much. This was a fantastic presentation, and I know what to talk about when you say we are all connected. We all come from God, and we are part of God. And do not fear. Live your life without fear.
Live your life without fear. That's the only way to live.
That's the best thing you can
do. I also work with many people who are afraid of death to help them live their lives.
Thank you so much, and
you're
may
welcome.
God bless you.
And thank you for having me. I really appreciate being able to open up like I have here today.
You had mentioned that you were told that if your husband stayed with you, you could help save him. Can you expand on that just a bit?
There is some fact, quite a bit about that in the Bible. May I? My husband is mentally ill. My husband is bipolar. And so from the time my husband was 15, he was trying to commit suicide. And I didn't know this when I married him. And so I went to school and became a counselor so I would understand mental illness so that I could help him. Because there's not a lot of available services, and there was a very large stigma to mental illness. I have also a trained counselor with NAMI right here in Salt Lake City. my husband and I are so connected, we can answer each other's questions before they're asked. And when something's wrong with him, such as the, what was it, 2 years ago? 2 years ago, the doctors were thinking he was having a breathing problem, and they wanted him to go in for sleep apnea, to put the oxygen on when he was at night. And then I got the signal that it wasn't his breathing, it was his heart. So I insisted very angrily that the doctor give us a heart surgeon. I took him in to St. George, where they expected nothing, and they tested him, and they said they were sorry, this was on a Friday, they said they were sorry they couldn't take him in to do an angioplasty that day. Monday at 7 a.m., he went in and had the angioplasty and had 4 stents put into his arteries, and the doctor said he should be dead. And the doctor said, I saved his life by bringing him in.
So you say that science gets it wrong about 50% of the time. Do you know why? Is it because have they got false facts? Have they got...
Well, our technology isn't advanced as it's going to be. I'm an electrical engineer, and so I did a lot of research and development myself. I went into it because of this near-death experience, and I studied physics and all of this into going into outer space, and they can only guess at what they're seeing. But the thing is, at least they're guessing. And so then the next scientist and the next piece of technology can see that much farther, can find out that much more, and build on that. But you'll find if you look at scientific history that you can go back and see what they said was the absolute truth that turned out not to be so true, but the next scientist can pick up on that and then say, okay, that was wrong, but what about this? So we're children still here on this planet, so we absolutely have to keep learning.
So they're basically having to, they're proving the theorems, and then they prove them either true or false.
Correct.
Is there a certain amount of corruption in the process that causes that?
Yes. One of the problems is pride. A lot of the scientists have pride in their theory, and they are totally not wanting to accept any other scientists to break their theory, so they almost bury the scientists. As I'm sure all of you know, if you study science, it was a Catholic priest who talked about the Big Bang Theory, and they totally humiliated him so he couldn't even write about his theory because he wasn't a member of the good old boys science club.
When you were talking about the future, did you get very many details about what's going to be happening in the future?
It was sporadic. It's not like the frustrating part for me is that I see things, but I'm not given the dates and the times. And that's very frustrating to not have all of the information. But the information is given to me as a form of acknowledgement that there is a God. The future is coming. Now, in 1969, if I told this to anyone, they would have locked me up in a mental ward. So the only two people I could actually talk to was my mother or my husband, who we've been married 51 years, and who was my very best friend, and who then went from being an atheist to believing. And so now I kind of at each beginning of each year say, okay honey, okay mom, look for this. And it helps them to believe because I can tell them what's going to happen. I knew my mother had cancer. She thought she had hives. And I told her to go into the doctor, and because she listened to me, they caught it in time and saved her life. And my mother is 91 years old. So a lot of what I see in the future is around family and friends.
Thank you for having me.